Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Marielle Smith, and I have the privilege today of talking and interviewing Jennifer Ingrassio. Jennifer is, first and foremost, a woman of great integrity, huge vulnerability, and a beautiful, humble eloquence. Her journey over the past 13 years is one that has always inspired me and offers me, every time we connect, a really great opportunity to look inside myself and to discover more about who I am. Really, it's because I admire the authenticity in her. And Jen's heart is literally out there for everyone to see, hear, and feel. And after reading her book, read about her heart. I'm so proud and honored to be with her today to talk about her last endeavor, a book that she wrote, Dreaming of Cupcakes, A Food Addict's Shamanic Journey into Healing. And I have to say, as I came near the end of the book, I found myself feeling more and more as I connected to her story, and it triggered some emotions in me that I had to face. And I kept reading through this very weird fog of liquid emotions coming out of my eyes. So this book is definitely an example of an honest, powerful, and healing story of addiction, and it touched something in me that I really desperately wanted everyone else to feel, although that's not a great expectation to have. I know I can't expect everyone to read it. However, this opportunity arose, and it's a great one for me to be able to talk more about the book with her. I also want to preface this by saying that this book is more than sort of the usual reliving of a story through anecdotes or journal entries. It, on the outside, flipping through, it might look like that, but it is really a courageous story of a woman's soul laid out in words and experiences, with her heart wide open. And I can promise and guarantee that you will find yourself questioning and reevaluating your own actions, your life, your inner voice, you know, your level of self-responsibility and healing, whether you have an addiction or you don't. And I feel like everyone that reads this will find inspiration through this journey. So Jen, welcome to our interview.
Wow, thank you, Marielle.
Yeah, the book really hit me in ways that I didn't expect. I actually feel quite teary thinking about it now, and being able to talk to you. You have a quote at the beginning from John Cantwell, and I just want to read that first. The title is, What is Shamanism? Shamanism is not a faith, but a wisdom tradition in which we learn purely from our own individual, collective, and personal experience. It is not a religion and is dogma-free. Indeed, it supports any existing spiritual practice one already has. Many of us deeply desire the connection to our own soulfulness and that of all other living beings in a free and natural way. This is the essence of shamanism, by John Cantwell. So where did you begin your journey with shamanism?
Well, in some ways, I think I've always had it since I was a kid. I wouldn't have called it shamanism back then, but it was definitely the natural world, and being out in nature was a solace, and it was a place where I could hear myself think, where I could feel what was going on inside of me, and where I could find direction. And from the time I was really little, I've always talked to spirit, or back then I called it God, because my family, we were practicing Catholics. But I never lost that connection. So I was saying to a friend last night, I made lots of mistakes in my life, but that's one thing I never lost was my connection to spirit. Mm. So to me, shamanism was just natural. It made sense for me to find healing by connecting with the powers of the universe and learning through experience, not just because somebody said something was the way it was. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know that inside myself, and I wanted to find that truth inside myself in a way that resonated for me.
Right. So your journey in this book is about food, mm-hmm. your challenge with food. Why did you pick shamanism? Or not pick it, but what, you know, based on the fact that we have all kinds of different modalities, what made you choose shamanism to work with your addiction?
I had worked with counselors and, you know, psychologists in the past, and the medical establishment in general, you know, going to my MD and stuff, not necessarily for addiction, but for other things, and I was never super impressed with how they addressed or didn't, what things they addressed, what things they didn't address. And I knew for me that I needed a holistic approach if I was going to come out of depression, come out of addiction. Mm. Like I couldn't use conventional forms, and I had tried, so I already knew that they were not a good fit for me. When I started studying shamanism seriously in 2005, and I started practicing and doing ceremony, it was the first thing in my entire life. I get emotional here. But it was the first thing that ever did it for me. Mm. Where I ever saw results.
Right.
And, let me collect myself here. because it didn't force me to be other than what I was mm-hmm. in the moment. And in fact, it kept bringing me back to who I was authentically, and then helping me to peel away the things, the habits, the patterns, the behaviors, and in some cases, sever relationships that weren't healthy for me. And that weren't helping me to heal or to be more of who I am. And at the heart of it, that's what addicts need to learn, is how to just be how they are in the world. Instead of trying to be what other people want them to be, or then playing the role of the screw up, or the person that never does anything right, or the black sheep, or the scapegoat. Mm. You know, all these roles are common with addicts. And so at the heart of it, shamanism helped me to get back the intimacy with myself and the comfortability with myself, with who I am, even though who I am is really different from who my relatives are, or who some of my friends are, and or who the world sometimes wants me to be.
Right.
And so for that reason, for me, that was the only choice.
It was a natural
And it was
choice.
The only thing that worked.
Mm-hmm. Right. How did you know that you had an addiction?
Well, I would say subconsciously I knew, but it wasn't conscious until I was in a sweat lodge one night. A sweat lodge is a ancient ceremony. Lots of people do it in different traditions. And it's very common here in North America among the indigenous people, different indigenous peoples. And I was praying in the lodge when that information came to me. That Jen, you know, I was praying about something in my life that wasn't working. I was having a hard time figuring out something. And when that came to me that I had an addiction, I went into denial pretty much right away. and I thought, well, you know, my cunning was at work. And I thought, well, that's a really strong word. you know. But of course, you know, when my ego started to do its little machinations, I thought, okay, Jen, there's something to this.
Right.
So, and it was true. I had a food addiction. Now, it wasn't to the extent where I was, like, not able to function or really unhealthy or immobile or anything like that, but it was any addiction, no matter where you are in the addiction, whether it's something that you just, you know, do sometimes or something that is just taking over your life, it takes energy. It takes life force energy. And for me, I didn't want to go through the rest of my life with that energy being used up in addiction. I wanted to figure out why I was doing those behaviors. And for me, I didn't want something outside of me controlling me. Mm. I didn't want to allow that. I wanted to be able to take command of what was going on inside of me and then make a choice in each moment how I was going to respond.
So would you say an addiction then is something that, like, if you don't really know that you have one, it's something that is draining your energy, you're tired, it takes life force energy? I mean, just for, you know, I guess for an example, people who may not know that there's something that's not working in their life, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it is, and it might be an addiction, but how do we pinpoint or how do we awaken to the fact that there might be something that's draining our energy that we can actually heal and have control of?
Yeah, I mean, I would say anytime you have a habit that you just do automatically or that you don't have a lot of control or command over,
it's an automatic.
You have to do it or you do it, whether it's compulsively working and never giving yourself a moment quiet or a moment for reflection, whether it's compulsively having sex with different partners or the same partner, but like that you need it in order to feel filled up or to feel like you are whole or accomplishing something. Of course, it doesn't do any of those things. But the key is that there's a command issue, that it's not actually me saying, you know what, I'm not going to drink that cup of coffee today. I'm going to choose this instead. Mm-hmm. It's like you just go straight for the cup of coffee.
Right.
Every time we sort of give our command over, we're leaking some of our life force energy. So it's not necessarily, do I have the cup of coffee or not?
Right.
Right? It's more like, okay, I'm thinking,
I want,
Jen, what does your body need today? And from that choice, making it from that choice instead of, I always have a cup of coffee in the morning.
Oh.
Or I always, you know what I mean?
So it's like my chai, my kids say I'm addicted. My kids say I'm addicted to chai lattes, right? Hmm. And I make them at home. So I don't go out to buy them. But for a while I was having them, I swear, almost every day, because it was such a love. And then all of a sudden I stopped for probably about a month. And it was weird because I was thinking, I really want to chai. And I'm like, but my body doesn't really want it. Mm-hmm. There's something that doesn't want it, something in me that doesn't want it. So I was, you know, with my kids' reflections, you know, Mom, you got an addiction. It's like, I need to look at that. So I think that's a great piece to change the question, instead of I always have my chai. What was the question?
What
do I need?
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's true. My body didn't need it, which is interesting. Mm. So that subtle voice of your body, how did you learn to listen to it?
Well, if you read the book, it's set out like a medicine wheel. And so, body, mind, spirit, heart, and life force energy are the main directions. People enter into addiction healing from a different place in the wheel. For me, I had to enter in through the body, through the West, because I didn't have a very conscious connection to my body. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn how to have a conscious connection with my body instead of just doing things automatically. Sometimes just doing the same thing every day. Your body doesn't want the same thing every day. So that kind of subtle listening did not come naturally to me. Well, I shouldn't say it didn't come naturally, but, you know, it's kind of taken out of us through all of the conditioning that we grow up with. You know, people telling us what to eat, when to eat, at school, when to go to the washroom, when not to go to the washroom. You know, like our bodies are not really under our control in this society for the first, you know, 17 years of our lives. So to expect that afterwards people are just going to know how to tune in and regulate is kind of silly, you know. So I had to learn all that.
Wow.
And it's still, today, I still have to be conscious because I still have those patterns of tuning out or going into automatic, especially when I'm stressed or when there's stressors in my environment.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say it's anything that ever goes away because it's in my neurology, but I definitely have learned how to catch myself if I'm in those moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a really great quote in your book that you pulled from Brené Brown, and I'd like to read that. When we can let go of what other people think and own our story, we gain access to our worthiness, which is the feeling that we are enough just as we are and that we are worthy of love and belonging. When we spend a lifetime trying to distance ourselves from the part of our lives that don't fit with who we think we're supposed to be, we stand outside of our story and hustle for our worthiness by constantly performing, perfecting, pleasing, and proving. Our sense of worthiness, that critically important piece that gives us access to love and belonging, lives inside of our story. Mm-hmm. So, your story. This incredible book. How did you come to sort of decide that you wanted to write it?
I did not want to write it.
Oh.
No, I was, when I finished the intensive addiction healing, I was probably a few months afterwards, I was walking, I was on a hike by myself, and while I was on the hike, I felt my grandpa's spirit really, really strongly. Now, he had passed away in 1990, so a long time before this hike. And he started to speak to me, and he was really quite adamant that I had to write the book. I didn't want to.
Oh my gosh.
So, but I mean, his reasons were really, really good. He said, you know, this is your legacy to your lineage, to your family. And we have had a lot of people with addiction issues in our lineage. And this book is a way of creating a different pathway, not only for descendants from our lineage, but you have to show people what it's like to have an addiction. Because people think that it's just easy. You can just choose yes or choose no, right? But it's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And there is intergenerational trauma that has to be considered that we inherit from our family.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't a book I wanted to write. It wasn't a fun book to write. It took me 3 years. Mm-hmm. Well, it took me 3 years to get off my, to get my ass in gear and get it going. And then when I started working on it, it took me another 3 years to figure out how to write it so that it was actually respectful of my family, of my lineage. Because I didn't want to go into a place where I was writing about my relatives in a way that was blaming or shaming, because that's not what the spirit of the book is about. It's about, well, how do we get here?
Mm-hmm.
And then when we're here, how do we heal? And how do we heal? And my family's not the only one that the story, you know, will pertain to, but how do we heal when we live in a family with addicts?
Right.
Right? And what's that process like? And how do you keep going when there's still people in your family that are trapped in addictions? You know? That's the challenging part of the whole thing, of writing the book.
So how has that gone? I mean, I have other questions, but that pops in. It's like, so how does that work? I have people in my life that have mm-hmm. similar situations, and so how do you live in a family that has addictions, or friends, or...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of us, if we're honest,
yeah.
people don't talk about this stuff because there's a lot of shame and a lot of stigma around it. But if we're honest,
we all have.
Who doesn't know yeah. somebody, whether they're a friend, whether they're a family member, whether they're a lover? We know somebody. Yeah. Everybody knows somebody that is struggling with addictions of some sort. Mm. Now, the severity, like how it's affecting their lives, might look very different from one person or another. You have people that are addicts that can still function and hold down a job, all the way to people that absolutely cannot.
Yeah.
And they're that have mental illness sort of wrapped up in, well, I feel like addiction is a mental illness
mm-hmm.
At its root.
Like a mental, emotional healing.
Yeah, it's a
wellness.
It's a physiological, psychological issue.
Right.
That stems from the way our beliefs work, our thoughts, our minds, like what we tell ourselves, but also like what we come to believe about the world,
yeah.
or about us in the world, right?
Yeah.
So we, those of us who are doing the healing work with our addictions are living in a world where there are addicts around us. So it is challenging.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I knew I was never going to get away from food. It's everywhere.
You have right? to eat to live.
I can choose to stay away from cocaine if I'm a cocaine addict, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I can move away. I can move somewhere. And I've known addicts that have done this, cocaine addicts or addicts
yeah.
where they move somewhere where there's no access to or right. limited right. access to those drugs, you know, so that when they're at a certain stage in their healing process, it's one less thing. Like, they can take that off the table. But for me, my particular
you want a
donut? Addiction...
you want,
right. and,
want some bread?
And the challenging thing is that it's an accepted addiction.
Oh.
I'm doing air quotes for those of you guys that are listening. So, it's accepted. People have food addictions. You know, they're addicted to coffee, they're addicted to sugar, they're addicted to blah, yeah. blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It seemed as an acceptable way...
Like a social addiction, almost.
Right. And I don't have a judgment around it.
Right.
And what I know for sure is that it takes life force energy to keep any addiction up.
Right.
So it wasn't reasonable for me to think, oh, well, I can just stay away from food. Well, no.
No.
Right?
Right.
So I had to learn how to work in the world, give myself what I needed, knowing that I wasn't going to be able to seal myself off from addicts, and I wasn't going to be able to seal myself off from food.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty huge.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a quote by you from the book. It took me a while to understand that I had no control over other people's perception of me. If I had... And all those years of people pleasing and doing everything others wanted me to do would have worked.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the people pleasing and the proving. I know there's people pleasing in me. There was the proving or being righteous in me. How did that piece pop into your awareness about, and how did you change it? How did you change having other people's judgments or perceptions not trigger you or affect you or have that big hit, that big kick in the stomach sometimes that we get when we're looking for that approval or we're looking for parents to be proud or to find that love, that sense of worthiness from mm-hmm. outside of ourselves. How did you get to the inside part?
Well, I mean, I think a part of it was I guess, again, that empirical nature of shamanism is that you're actually learning through experience. And logically, if it were true that you would be accepted and that the people would love you and accept you as you are if you do what they want you to do, then logically, if you do what they want you to do, then you're going to feel loved. You're going to feel like it's working.
Right.
And yet it never does. You know, so I was contorting myself into all these different positions, trying to be something that I'm not and someone I wasn't, hoping that I was going to feel seen by the people that I loved. And it's not just my family, but it extended to friends, it extended to coworkers. Like, it was just like a plague on my entire life, right? Teachers, mentors, you know. And the fact was that it never worked. So for me, I started thinking, well, Jen, if that doesn't work, if that's not true, then where are you going to get your sense of self-worth? How are you ever going to feel like you're enough? It can't come from the outside. It has to come from you give yourself, like back to that Brené Brown quote, you give yourself permission to be enough just because you survived, you made it. You know, the chances of any of us being here are very slim. If you look at the statistics of an egg and sperm coming together and, you know, someone making it to full gestation, you know, it's very slim. And it's like, but we all of us that are here in a physical body have managed to do that trick.
Right.
So that tells us something already about our worthiness and our ability to thrive, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
I've never really thought of it that way before, going back that far.
Mm-hmm.
Just how I say magical. I mean, when I was pregnant, I had this little alien thing growing in me, and how did that really happen? And do I really want this to be happening? But I have no control over it. So it is one of those things. I get that. Along your journey, again, just reading this book, I had this experience at the very beginning of reading and then having to stop. And reading and having to stop. And I wasn't sure at the beginning why I had to stop until I mentioned to you, yeah, I'm only a third of the way through and have to stop after a chapter, or maybe, I don't even know if I made it through two ever, until the end of the book. What do you think it is about these chapters that had me have to pause? Like, I found myself needing to look inside.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself reliving experience that I had walking next to somebody with an addiction, or just looking at my own, oh my God, am I addicted to my chai? Am I addicted to my phone? Am I addicted, you know, what? I started really going on the inside.
Mm.
So I'm curious about that piece. I mean, obviously everyone has different reactions and different, are impacted differently by reading your book. But what are your thoughts on that, that piece?
Well, everybody that's read the book that I've had feedback from has said the same thing.
Okay.
It's not a fast read. And, you know, they read a chapter and then you have to stop. And I'm really happy about that, because essentially what it is, it's a book about truth, about being honest. And we're not really honest with ourselves in everyday life. You know, we haven't been trained to be honest with ourselves, because in our society, people equate honesty, or just looking at the truth of how things are, like, they couple that with sort of beating themselves up. So it's like they can't look at something honestly without going into that painful process of beating themselves up.
Right.
So then, as a consequence, it's just something we don't do. It's like, I can't be honest, I can't even look at what's there, because then I have to deal with what's there.
Right.
Right? Now, you and I, because we've both been practicing shamanism for a while, that's what it's all about. So we're used to being honest with ourselves and looking at things that aren't so pretty about ourselves, but learning to do it in a way that's compassionate and in a way that moves us forward. So we can look at those pieces and we can go, okay, I didn't have a good moment right there. Why didn't I have a good moment right there? What do I need to forgive myself for? But what did I do well in that moment? And then what can I do differently next time?
Right.
Right? So those are very, it's a very basic structure that we're not taught unless we're trained to do it, like you and I have been through ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't help to look at ourselves honestly and then to go through that massive beating up process. Now, that doesn't mean there's not going to be regret or like, shit, why did I spend so long in that energy? Or why did I do that to myself for such a long time?
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got to climb out of this, right? So yeah, there can be anger, there can be rage, there can be all sorts of things. But we can learn to go through those things in a compassionate way. So yeah, you can't blaze through the book like you're reading a Harlequin novel. That's not how it works.
It was right? Impossible.
Yeah, and if it was fast, if there was a easy track to healing addictions, everybody would be able to do it and would do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there's not. And so we have to... I wanted it to be a book where people could see the addict's journey, but also where they could see the process I went through inside of myself to heal.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the piece that's usually invisible for those people who are able to heal their addictions.
It is absolutely invisible.
Right.
Yes.
And I don't know anybody that has been able to heal an addiction long term that only deals with one aspect of themselves, like the physical, like the withdrawal, with like the chemical. You need to couple it with a mental process, with a spiritual process, however that looks like for you, even if spirit for you is, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
At my essence.
Just going inside.
Right. Even if you don't believe in God or
yeah.
That's not what this is about, it's who am I really? Like, and how do I want to show up in the world?
Right.
From that place of who am I? And your heart, you've got to be able to look at your emotions. What are you doing with your life force energy? With your sexual energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things, all those pieces have to be touched on and explored if the healing's going to last long term. And then it has to be coupled with good community support. You can't do it. I don't know anybody who's been able to do it on their own long term.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe there are people out there. I don't know. You know, please don't, you know, email me. I'm sure there are people, but
this is your
the vast
experience.
Majority of people that I meet, that has not been the case for them, because we're social creatures, assuming.
So, speaking of time, how long did this journey take for you to feel like, okay, I've healed my addiction?
So, I was working every day with my teacher for over a year.
Okay.
Just over a year. So, it was... It was pretty intense. A year is kind of the minimum, depending on what your addictions are, how many addictions you have, because mm-hmm. some people have multiple ones, so then you know, tackle that by working on the ones that are affecting them the most and then working backwards.
Yeah.
It might take years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a quick fix, but the other thing is that it makes a difference being able to be a part of a community that accepts you as you are in the moment. And that doesn't mean that you show up as your best self, in quotations. You show up the way that you are, and then in that moment. And then you deal with what's going on in that moment. You know, so it is a moment-by-moment process. I couldn't think about the end. It took all my energy just to figure out how I was gonna navigate some of the situations I found myself in during the day without going to food and doing all those other behaviors that I had learned to do for coping, you know.
Right.
So
Well, and being offered things with families. I kept reading those experiences like, oh my goodness, she's being offered something and she has to say no. And that's one of the biggest stressors for some people is to say no, thank you. I don't want that.
Well, you come from a Chinese family. Yeah. I come from a Portuguese family. You know, it's similar for, you know, my Italian friends. One of the things I had to learn was that food is not love. It's not, they're not equal. Food is a source of energy. And it's, of course, it's pleasurable. Like, I love eating. But I had to learn how to navigate a family culture that was all around food is love. So if I deny, you know, that Portuguese cake or, you know, whatever was on offer, Portuguese bun or...
Oh, gosh.
Whatever it was. So it's, you know, this is part of their hospitality tradition in Portuguese culture and same Chinese, right?
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, I was so afraid to offend people, right? But I had to learn how to just go, no, I just have to do what's good for me in this situation. And nobody knew I was healing an addiction either.
Okay.
So, in my situation, I felt that it would be easier for my healing if I didn't tell my family, because they would worry. And no one had the experience or expertise to support me anyway, right? So I thought, why do that to them?
Like, or you, right?
Or me, right? Whereas there are other people that I know have told their families, look, I'm healing this addiction. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, please do not offer me this or, you know, but part of my challenge was that I actually wanted to learn how to navigate was, you know, there are people that are going to be enabling you unknowingly all the time. How do you deal with those situations? How do I say no to my aunt offering me a piece of cake? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then insisting that I eat the cake, even though I said no. You know, I had to learn how to just say, no, I'm not eating it, and after she cuts it, and blah, 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 right?
Oh, no.
And then be okay with the fact that she was a bit miffed.
Right.
Right? So it was a learning for me. And it's like, and it doesn't mean I don't love her, exactly. Or that I don't think the cake is great, or, you know, whatever it is, right?
It's not a personal attack.
No. So I did that enough times where I realized, okay, this is something I can navigate in any situation. And my family was the best testing ground because, of course, it's hardest in families, right? If you can do it in your family and do it well, you know, hold your neutrality well, then you can probably do it anywhere. So I'm sorry to my family, but... I did use them as a testing ground a lot, right?
Oh, no.
I'd fly home, and I'm like, okay, let's see how I do at the dinner table.
Your Petri dish family.
That's right. You know, my mom later, after she found out that I did this work, she was like, I had a feeling something was going on. I was like, yeah.
Well. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's so interesting. Well, interesting is probably not a great word. It fascinates me. Because boundary setting is what sort of popped into my mind.
Mm.
We, as a culture, many cultures, have a difficult time with setting our boundaries. It's such an uncomfortable thing to learn to say no. Mm-hmm. Or, just no, I don't want a hug, even.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. I saw a video today teaching these little people, they're like 4 years old, about mm-hmm. consent. And I'm fascinated, like, oh my goodness, that would have been amazing to have as a child, you know, mm-hmm. to not have to have my cheeks squeezed by my uncle until they turned red. And I was afraid, I honestly was afraid of him. Every time he came to visit, I would hide
mm-hmm.
because he would pinch my cheeks because they were so fat mm-hmm. when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
He loved them. Like, that's nice. But it hurts when you pinch me, you know? So the boundary setting I get is part of that healing journey
yeah.
as well.
And it's important, I think, too, to realize that cultures have their way of doing things, the ways that are kind of normalized. But personal boundaries are really important. And just because something is acceptable in a culture doesn't mean that it's going to be okay for that individual.
Mm.
And so part of it is learning how to assert yourself as an individual in a cultural framework, which we all have. Yeah. We're all born into cultural frameworks, right?
Yeah.
And making sure that you can do that. You can do that within your cultural framework. You're not going to be popular. People,
this is true.
People are going to be upset with you when you start to put your boundaries down and enforce them. You know, they're gonna tell you you're selfish. They're gonna be angry with you. They're gonna maybe have some passive aggressive behaviors. You know, there's gonna be all sorts of things. That's how you know your boundary's working, because you piss someone off enough that they're being vocal about it.
Oh my gosh.
You know, so we can see that as progress
and a victory.
It's not comfortable.
No,
but it's like, okay, I won for myself, because I stood for what I needed.
Mm.
Even though, yeah, it's causing a few ruffles in my relationships. But in the end, it's like you get to see what the relationships are made of, and which ones stay with you and can grow with you, and which ones can't. And the ones that can't, or that don't grow with you through those ruffles, that's okay. And some of those people might be family members, like cousins, sisters, brothers. That's okay.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't mean we can't have respect for those people still, and be kind with them at family functions. But it's like, who are you going to allow into your inner circle? That will really support you in your life. Maybe it's 5 people. Maybe none of those are family members. Maybe all of them are family members. We don't know. It's going to look different for everybody. But it's like that's the kind of thing that we have to start looking at. I've known addicts that have had to leave their entire lives behind. They've had to never communicate with their family members again, never communicate with friends. Because those people were not people that they could keep engaging with in a healthy way and heal their addiction.
Wow.
Right? Like, if you're growing up in a community that's full of addiction,
right,
you know, the chances of you being able to still maintain some of those relationships are probably not very high. And so for those people, I think, how courageous, because that's hard.
That's pretty cool.
It's hard to leave all the people that you love.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, yes, the relationships aren't healthy.
Yeah.
But sometimes it means having to leave relationships behind.
How would you choose those people that support you? How have you chosen those people?
I don't know if I've chosen those people.
they chose you.
I think by choosing a shamanic path, you know, I am already immersed in a community of like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that we're all vastly different. I mean, I would never be friends with these people if I was just going through my regular life without shamanism. They're all ages, they're all cultures, they're, you know, they're all different professional backgrounds. Like, you know, it's such a mishmash of people. But one thing we all have in common is we all didn't feel like we sort of fit in the conventional world. We didn't feel like the way that we experienced the world was the same as the way other people were experiencing so-called consensual reality. We're like, whoa, there's other aspects of life that are present that people aren't acknowledging, but that we experience. And so that's been really great, because yeah, we're all different, but it's like everybody that practices shamanism is like, this is something that makes sense to us. We understand this, and it helps us to function in the world better, because we found other people that understand the world this way.
Right.
You know, for me, talking to my dead grandpa, that's normal. And I don't need to go to a psych ward. For somebody who's living in mainstream consensual reality, it would be concerning.
Yeah, right.
You know? So I'm saying this on the radio. For people probably interested in shamanic medicine and addiction healing. But I, you know, it took a long time, for instance, for me to announce these kinds of things professionally.
Right.
Because I'm thinking, okay, I'm a teacher, you know.
Teaching kids. And
that's right. But the thing was, there did come a point where it was like, that's okay. You know, we all experience the world in a different way. And so it's important to find people who understand your worldview. You know, that doesn't mean that you discount everybody else's worldview, but it means that with these people, you don't have to explain everything.
Right.
It's like, okay, we're starting from the same foundation. And so now I can just do my healing work with these people and we can all hold space for each other in the way that we hold space for each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important. And it doesn't mean I don't have family members and other friends outside of shamanism that I also can go to and that I love and can talk to about things, but it's a different kind of support.
Right.
You know, I needed that spiritual piece as a central foundational part. And my friends and my family can't always meet me at that level, but they offer different kind of support. Yeah.
Right. So really having that foundational community
mm-hmm.
is important for this journey.
Yeah.
Mm. At the end of all this, your book is out.
Mm-hmm.
It's been out for a little while. What's been your experience since?
Mm-hmm.
And what are some of the key experiences or impacts that have happened for you since releasing your book? Putting your story way out into the world.
I'm an introverted person by nature. I was talking to my mom about this yesterday, and it's not comfortable for me to be out in the world. I would much rather not have such a big digital fingerprint. You know, I would
it's a footprint.
Or a footprint, yeah. I would rather the fingerprint.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was thinking. Like, you just want to.
But, you know, I Google my name and I'm like,
oh God.
You know, there's a part of me that's like, Jen, what are you doing? But there's another part of me that's like, life is an adventure. And I'm one of these people that if spirit asks me to do something, and if I feel like it's mine to do, and then I have to do it.
Yeah.
And I have to find a way of navigating through my resistance and, you know, I don't want my picture on the internet. I don't want a website. I don't want to, and I went through all that stuff. I don't want to write, I wanted to write the books, but I didn't want necessarily.
I don't want my name on it.
But there's also a sort of hiding that goes along with that, that I just couldn't, that is not in my value system. And so it's been a great challenge because I have to keep finding ways to meet that energy inside of me that would really just rather be like a bit of a hermit, an unknown hermit. Not that I'm, you know, widely known or anything, but that's not my goal. But it is a little bit uncomfortable. And at the same time, I think it's some of my best image makers have been people that have shared their painful and sometimes shame-inducing stories with me as teaching tools, you know. A lot of my friends have very colorful pasts, you know, and they're some of the most amazing people that I've ever met. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be described as perfect people, in quotations, or the world's most upstanding citizens. But there is a certain courage in being vulnerable and allowing ourselves to be seen that I value. And so because I value it, then I have to live it. And it's not comfortable. I don't like it.
That's pretty clear now.
However, I do it.
Yeah.
Because it feels right.
Yeah.
And it feels like, you know, if that's my legacy, yeah. and if that's something that I can leave for future generations, not only my family, but for other people, then I'm good with that. And I'd rather have it coming from me, my stories coming from me, than stories about me coming from other people that may be seeing it through a different lens.
Right.
You know, these are my experiences, and I understand that my family and friends will have different experiences of me. But this is what I went through on the inside, and only I can tell that story.
Right.
Mm. And that was important for me, too, to put it out as my story.
Well, you did it in a hugely authentic way that really hits the heart. It really does.
It's real.
Anything you want to leave our listeners for their journeys with or without addiction? Or
yeah, you know, life is an adventure. That's what I'll say. And it doesn't really matter what we've done in our past. There's always a way to heal from things that have happened to us, from things we've done, from things we can't take back. So to keep going until people find the support networks and the communities that see them, that share a similar worldview, that can be a worldview they can grow from. Not a worldview that shuts out other worldviews, but a worldview where it's like, okay, this is how I operate in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so going from that place, that we can all do that if we seek that out. And it might not be shamanism for everybody. I'm quite aware of that, and that's okay. But this is the story of why shamanism worked for me and how I used it. And if that opens up pathways to other people, like, oh, I never thought I could take a spiritual approach to healing addiction. And they look somewhere else, whether that's NA or AA or many of the other programs that are out there, then that's wonderful.
Right.
I did my job.
Right. Well, because this book is more than just about a food addiction.
That's right.
It's much bigger.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, my friend Jeremy says, Jen, this is a book about addiction. I go, right. I wanted people to know what it was like.
Yeah. Well, like I said at the beginning, it is a courageous... it's a courageous book. Absolutely. I will promise and guarantee anyone that reads this book will gain some beautiful insights and a journey into yourself that you probably didn't expect. And finding some access to what I want to call like self-sovereignty, self-responsibility, a level of being able to... I like your word, command, have command over my life or over your life. And it is a fierce and humble journey that this book reveals. Thank you for being with me today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to read the book and for giving such good feedback.
I couldn't have done anything else. When I cried at the end, it was just so... I was like, holy shit, I did not expect that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just didn't expect my heart to be cracked open in a way that it was. And I'm still moving through it. Like, I finished the book recently, right? And it still sits with me. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been here for a few days, and I see you, and I go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah, I remember that. And then I saw my friend Janie. I'm like, okay, you might want to read this book. It's really great. You'll just learn so much about yourself. Anyways, thank you. Thank you, thank you.
You're very welcome. And the book is widely available, like, all over the world, so on all the major online sites, like Amazon, Goodreads, Balboa, Chapters, I do go here, and Barnes & Noble, so...
Awesome.
If people want to get it, it's pretty easy to get.
I will put some links. I'll put some links in.
Thank you. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for listening today. I hope that you got as many gems from this conversation as I did, and I invite you to share this with friends, family, and wherever you feel it's needed, on social media, through word of mouth, sending someone an email. This conversation I had with Jen Ingrassio is really what brings me joy and opens my heart, because when we can talk about our life's journey with the abandon and the naturalness and the honesty that she does in her book and in this interview, and when people are given the space to do so, more healing can happen. I am grateful for the time that you set aside to listen and to be with us today. Until next time, I'm Marielle Smith, sending you off with much love and gratitude.